broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Hey, thanks for your donation this past week. More than 2,000 people donated to keep WMNF on the air, and we reached our goal of $235,000 yesterday morning. That keeps WMNF secure for 4 more months. As a donor, you've placed a lot of trust in WMNF, and we'll try to reflect that trust back in the good stewardship we do of your donation. Well, coming up today, we'll get an update about hurricane relief from some local FEMA staffers. And later, U.S. economy is changing. Full-time employment with benefits is shifting to part-time temporary employment. It's a big reason why the middle class is shrinking here in the U.S. We're going to look at how and why we're seeing the rise of temporary jobs with no benefits. Economists call it the Uber economy. More about that later. But first, FEMA. We're joined by Robert Burke, who's a media relations specialist with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And Steve Solomon is here. He's also a media relations specialist. And Robert, thanks for coming by WMNF. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
So I think the main reason that you planned, you wanted to come here was to talk about how people can apply for FEMA relief aid. And let me start with, who's eligible for aid from FEMA?
Well, any individual that doesn't have insurance or has gaps in their insurance, that suffers some significant loss or damage to their home or loss.
Damage to their home, can it also be damage to their property?
Yes.
Can it be damage to their car?
Yes.
All right. So anything that you own that was damaged as a result of the hurricane that's not covered by insurance or only partially covered, then you might be able to get some help from. And what we're talking about, cash help, is this money?
It's money, but it's deposited directly into an account, and you have to spend the money, what it's for.
Okay, so you've got a guarantee that you've spent it. If your roof was damaged, that you've got
to keep those receipts because you may have to produce them.
Ah, okay, all right.
That eliminates fraud.
All right. Have a lot of people signed up for relief after the hurricane?
Not sure on the numbers right now, but with the avenues that people are applying online, going to the DRC centers, and by phone, we haven't compiled all those numbers yet.
Okay. All right. Stephen, did you want to add something to that?
Well, I would just say an eligible survivor would be anybody who was living in a designated county on the date of the disaster, meaning when Hurricane Irma struck. And a designated county is a county that the president declared eligible for federal assistance. So Hillsborough County, as an example, is one of the 48 counties in Florida that has been designated. You're considered a survivor if you were, in fact, living in Hillsborough County at that time. And beyond that, if you register, we will help you determine whether, in fact, you are eligible for federal assistance.
Robert, let's say I was put out of work. Let's say that I worked at a landscaping company or maybe a restaurant, and for 3 or 4 days the electricity was out at the restaurant, or for 3 or 4 days we had no lawns to take care of. Am I eligible for FEMA relief, or is there some other program that I could apply to?
Well, there are other programs that the state and DCF has. They have something called, FEMA has something called a program for critical needs. And that's a one-time payment for essential things like medicine, food that, you know, that was spoiled, and other necessities.
And how do I reach that program?
All you have to do is, it's easy to go online and at disasterassistance.gov. All one word, disasterassistance.gov. Or you can call FEMA at 800-621-FEMA or 800-621-3362.
So you're also here to urge people to go online and make their application for disaster relief online. Why is that?
One, I believe it's much easier. You can do it the comfort of your home. You can do it when you have the time, or you can call. The DRCs are so spread out, and
what's a DRC?
Disaster Relief Center.
Okay, so they're so spread out, so that if you decide to drive over to one, what happens if I drive over to one?
Well, I think the time that you take to drive over to one, you could do this thing online.
Okay, all right. You also want us to know that it's really important that people fill out the form correctly.
Correctly, complete, and sign it.
And you can do that online?
Yes, you can.
All right, where can you do that online? What's the address?
Disasterassistance.gov.
The one you just gave out?
Yes.
And so how long do people have to make an application to FEMA if their car was damaged or if their roof was damaged? How long do they have to make an application to FEMA?
Right now, I'm not familiar. Steve, do you know what the deadline is?
It's 30 days from the date of the disaster. So at this point, the disaster declaration. So that designation would put us at... And I'm flipping through my papers here.
I think it's today.
It's
not today.
I wanted to say, yeah, that's a great question. Let me get back to you while I shuffle through my papers here. It's in November, actually.
Okay, so...
November 9th, I believe.
Right. Yeah.
Now, the signal of this radio station reaches all of Hillsborough, but it also reaches in Polk and Manatee and Sarasota. It reaches Hardy, Citrus, Hernando, Pinellas, Pasco, and even some adjacent counties, too.
That's all seven counties.
Okay, so, and all those counties are part of this disaster area.
That's correct.
All right, here's a question from one of our listeners. His name is Rob, and he said, I had damage to my home during the storm, and FEMA denied me due to having homeowner's insurance. My homeowner's insurance deductible, though, is $8,000. But FEMA still denied my claim. I uploaded my denial letter to the FEMA Disaster Relief website. Well, maybe I read this wrong. He says my home insurance hurricane deductible is $8,000, so they denied my claim. So he had damage, I guess, that was under $8,000. And so I uploaded my denial letter from my insurance company to the FEMA Disaster Relief website. Is there a chance that FEMA will still help me? And how long does the appeal process usually take? That's Rob in St. Petersburg.
Well, I don't know how long the appeal will take, but it's good he's appealing it. That's something that they have to handle in mitigation. I'm not familiar with that.
Can I hire a lawyer if I feel like FEMA is not doing right by me?
I'm sure you can, yes.
All right. We're just doing a little bit of investigation to what FEMA is doing a month after the Hurricane Irma hit here in the Tampa Bay area. And our guests are Robert Burke, and also here is Stephen Solomon. Both are media relations specialists with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. So the best thing to do is to make your application online. Don't go down to the FEMA's office. Is there a long line there at the office?
Some are, some aren't.
You know, if I can interrupt, the thing about the disaster recovery centers is that some people relate better person to person and face to face. So we encourage folks who, for whatever reason, might be uncomfortable with trying to do this on their computer at home, or perhaps they don't have one, by all means, visit the center. We are typically staffed for folks who speak other languages than English. And we like to call a disaster recovery center a one-stop shop location, because in addition to FEMA having representatives there, there are also folks from the U.S. Small Business Administration. And despite its name, the Small Business Administration also makes very low-interest loans to individuals. And in the case of a disaster, it's strongly advise that survivors who have had damage also apply for a loan with the SBA, and if rejected, you're referred back to FEMA for other assistance that you would not have normally been eligible for. And in any case, an SBA loan does not have to be accepted. You don't have to take it if you don't want it. And in addition, there are typically at the DRCs, the disaster recovery centers, representatives from other agencies, state, and in some cases county or local, that can help you do things like explore the program for disaster unemployment insurance that you were talking about earlier in the program.
Where can people find a list of the local disaster recovery centers?
On disasterassistance.gov.
All right, that's a great website. All right, let's take a call from Deborah, who's in St. Petersburg. Hi, Deborah, you're on the air. Thank you for calling in. Do you have a question for our FEMA guests?
Yes, good morning. One of my friends said he read the fine print, and the fine print on this said something along the lines of that it's more like a loan than it is actual handing out of money, and that the money would be taken out of your tax returns afterwards. Is that correct?
Good morning, and you can tell your friend that a FEMA grant is not a loan. It does not have to be repaid. It is not considered taxable income, and it does not affect any other federal benefits you're receiving, such as Social Security, Medicare, or SNAP assistance. So
Great. That's
incorrect. Not taxed, not a loan.
Okay, maybe it was something else he was looking at.
Sure, no problem.
Great, thanks for clearing that up.
All right,
you're
Deborah,
welcome.
Thanks a lot. Now, Ted in Dade City says, how does one revise a form that's already been submitted to FEMA? If I've already submitted an application for disaster aid and I want to change it, how do I go back and change it?
Well, two things. He has a registration number, and he can call the FEMA directly at 800-621-3362.
And just give that registration number, and then somebody at the other end.
Correct. They can bring up his file.
Is there a long wait when you call in? When you call that 800-621 FEMA number, is there a long wait online?
I would say no longer than any other 800 number that you call.
Okay.
FEMA, again, in all fairness to folks who are going to call, we're experiencing a very heavy volume of calls right now because of all of these disasters that have hit in the last few weeks, not just in Florida, but Texas, Georgia, and of course Puerto Rico. So some of the call time waits can be significant. If you call let's say later hours, you might get in quicker. But I would say that yes, if you call, expect a fairly long wait, and that's why we encourage folks to go to the website.
What are the hours that the 800 number is open? Is it open 24/7?
It's 24/7 now. That could change. So I would say yes, but
okay. Don't just if you're going to do it right
and,
now.
Yeah, and also like a disaster recovery center. Okay. But FEMA's pledge is to be here, to have a presence here, as long as it takes to register every eligible survivor for the assistance they're entitled to.
Could I ask how long both of you have been working for FEMA?
I've been in a little over 8 years, sir.
8 years. And Robert?
7 months.
7 months. All right. Let's go to Mark, who's in Tampa. Mark, thanks for calling in. What's your question for our FEMA experts?
I'm a musician, and Monday night, another musician friend of mine told me he lost 4 gigs because of the hurricane. Is that covered?
All right, so you're out of work, or you know a guy who's out of work because of the hurricane.
Right.
All right.
Four nights.
All right. And Mark, your friend, how much do you think your friend lost because of the hurricane?
I'd say $125 a night.
Okay, all right. Mark, good question. Does FEMA help people who are unemployed or out of work because of we talked about this earlier.
Yeah, FEMA does not. It's a state program, and their criteria I can't speak to. But if you want information, again, call our number. We can give you the number to call for the state information, and they can go through that with you. I just don't have that information.
So there is a state program for people who are out of work because of the hurricane?
Yes. I think it probably goes through the state unemployment insurance.
All right. So, Mark, did you get that?
Yes, I did. Thank you very much.
Mark, thank you very much, too. And so the bottom line is that you think that you're going to be able to get your claim faster in if you go online. Do you know how long it takes for FEMA to issue that check, put that check in the account? Do you know how long it takes?
Again, because of the volume of registrations that FEMA is handling right now, it can take longer because there's a step in between that we haven't talked about, and that's after you've registered. We're going to contact you. One of our housing inspectors is going to contact you to make an appointment to schedule a visit to the property to actually look at it. That could take several weeks.
So there's an on-site inspection of the property.
To verify the damage, yes.
To verify the damage, all right. And
So the inspector will go out to that property. There has to be someone at least 18 years old to meet that inspector. There is no fee, and I point that out. We haven't really talked about fraud or scams yet, but there is no charge, no fee from any inspection by FEMA. That individual will look at the property, may take some pictures. The housing inspector does not determine whether you're eligible, only gathers the information to give it back to FEMA to make that determination.
How do I tell if I'm dealing with a FEMA person? I mean, do you have IDs, or what do I look for when somebody comes to my house?
They do have IDs, and it says FEMA Department of Homeland Security on it.
All right, let's go to Maria, who's in South Pasadena. Hi, Maria. How are you?
Hi. Well, I'm concerned. Both my parents are Puerto Rican. I was born and raised in New York City, and I still have plenty of family in Puerto Rico. We're getting reports from various family members, even those who live in the metropolitan area, that they are lacking water and electricity and various issues. The specific question I have is about my aunt. She's 89 years old. She is disabled, very limited walking, and she's been staying with her daughter, my cousin, but my cousin is no longer able to take care of her under these conditions. What are their options?
All right. So, Stephen, what would you say?
Well, first let me express my deepest concern for what you're going through and your family over there in Puerto Rico. I'm here as a representative of FEMA and what FEMA is doing in the state of Florida. I don't have Puerto Rico specific information on hand to help you with those questions. I would suggest that, like we're advising survivors here, if there's any way you can ensure that they're trying to contact FEMA over in Puerto Rico, again through that website, phone number, however they can. I'm only reading reports about what's going on over there, like you are in the news. From my understanding, there are thousands of federal employees there now trying to assist. I truly feel what you must be going through with the situation, but I just don't have specific information for there.
I see. So there, you don't know if any like specific. If I go to that web page, will that take me to a place that deals with Puerto Rico specifically?
Well, you know, if you go to FEMA.gov, that website, you can use the search engine there to access every bit of information that FEMA has released publicly about the response to Puerto Rico. So you would have access to the news releases and fact sheets and whatnot that are posted there. And there might be information on those web pages that could help you focus closer to what you're trying to find out.
Okay, and I'm sorry to take your time, but one more question about Puerto Rico. What made me much more concerned about this was the president's tweet about Puerto Rico that they cannot help Puerto Rico with assistance forever, quote unquote. Do you have any idea what he means by that?
We have no idea what that means. The president means what he means, and that's his opinion, and that's his verbiage. That's all I can tell you.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you for your time today, sir.
You're all right, Maria, thank you very much. That is a terrible position to be in. I mean, I might try to call my U.S. senator and both of them and see what they might be able to do to try to rush more assistance to people who are elderly in Puerto Rico without any sort of aid. I got to say that you guys are staffers. You don't come up with policy here, so no. So you're just here to tell us what's available locally. I want to thank you, Robert Burke and Stephen Solomon. Thank you for coming by WMNF. Good to have you here. And again, if you want to call the FEMA number, it's 1-800-621-FEMA. And put in your registration for help at FEMA. And then also, what's the website?
DisasterAssistance, all one word, .gov.
All right. Well, Robert and Stephen, thanks a lot for coming by WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
All right. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're going to shift gears and discuss the disappearance of middle-class jobs in the U.S. We're going to look at two phenomena, the growth of giant predatory capitalist companies who are trying to eliminate competition. And we'll look at a new trend in work, migrant workers of a different type, people living in mobile homes, traveling from job to job through the country. First, I often tell you about the informative programming on our HD3 channel. It's an all news and talk channel that we created a few years ago, which features programs like Alternative Radio and the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. You can listen to it by using your WMNF phone app. You can look for it at the source. You can listen to it using your computer. You can find it at wmnf.org/listen. Well, one of the programs we carry on the source is To the Best of Our Knowledge. It airs Sunday mornings, or rather Saturday mornings. And recently the program looked at how the digital economy is changing the nature of employment here in the U.S. The digital economy was supposed to help all of us gain access to meaningful work. Computers would do the boring jobs while people did the stuff that matters. Instead, we've got full-time workers replaced by robots and taxi drivers who are losing out to Uber. What went wrong? Well, media theorist Doug Rushkoff has a word for it. He calls it growth. He spoke with Steve Paulson of the program To the Best of Our Knowledge.
Wasn't the digital economy supposed to fix all this? And computers would do the boring jobs while people did the stuff that's fun and that matters. Instead, you know, we've got workers replaced by robots, taxi drivers, losing out to Uber, and all those disruptive new media companies. Yeah, they're all laying off creative staff. So what went wrong? Media theorist Doug Rushkoff has a word for it, growth. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with him about his new book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus.
Doug, the subtitle of your new book is How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity, which I have to say sounds counterintuitive. Most people would say that growth goes hand in hand with prosperity.
Yeah.
So why is growth the enemy of prosperity?
You know, you would think it goes hand in hand, wouldn't you? I would have. The reason why is that for the most part now, companies grow by extracting money from people and places and some viable marketplace, and then store that growth in share price. And when it's stuck in share price, it ends up really stuck there, almost like a frozen asset that they can't get back into circulation.
So you're saying the companies don't plow that money back into the business itself?
Right. And that's because they're punished, really, if they do that. You know, particularly in the digital economy, there's a real stigma associated with earnings. So you can have a company like Twitter, which makes $500 million a quarter, right? That's $2 billion of revenue a year. And that's considered an abject failure by Wall Street.
Wait, really? They're not making enough money?
They're not supposed to make money. That's the problem. If they make money, then you've got to be taxed on it. That's revenue. They don't want revenue. They want growth.
Explain the difference between growth and revenue.
There's the number of users on Twitter has stopped. It's now a great, sustainable, viable, revenue-based business. That means it's sort of standing still as far as investors are concerned. Investors buy stocks, and they don't want to get dividends from those stocks. They don't want earnings. They want the stock price to go up, because that's an easy way to make money and not pay taxes. Your stocks go up. You want to see that line go up. Growth, we value growth. We think growth is the way to get richer, to do better, to make our country great. Grow, grow, grow. But it turns out growth of shares is very different from having a healthy, sustainable, revenue-generating business. And that confusion, really, is at the core of why our digital economy is not rewarding people.
I want to take you back for a moment to the Twitter example, because you actually know one of the co-founders, Evan Williams, right?
Yeah, I actually know a couple of them. I mean, I knew him when he was, just looking for that next $100 to get, to keep his servers up. But when I saw him on the cover of the Wall Street Journal the morning that Twitter had its IPO, and they had the number 4.3 billion under his face, which is the amount of money he earned that morning.
Wait, so one day he was suddenly $4.3 billion richer?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to feel good. I mean, it's because they went public. But, I was also sad for him, because I realized by taking $4.3 billion, he was going to surrender his company to this growth trap, that now he was having investors who were expecting what they call 100x or 1000x returns. They put in money at that $4.3 billion, but they did it because they wanted the company to be worth $400 billion within a year or two. That's what they wanted, was growth, not revenue. And I realized he had really given up his company, that he had, in some sense, killed the dream, because now Twitter, which is a successful company doing what it does, is going to be forced to do this very dot-com thing that they call pivoting. When a company pivots, it means get out of that business that you're in, that revenue-generating business, and go towards growth, even if you have to cannibalize yourself. Sell off your most productive assets. Sell your good businesses so that your share price will go up, and then we can sell our shares to the next round of investors. And you keep doing that until the company's dead.
Well, let's talk about another example. I mean, one of the hot tech companies is Uber, the ride-hailing service. I mean, you have argued that ultimately this is not a business about getting people to their destination. It's a business model. Do you want to explain
that?
Right.
It's a very particular, it's a very particular business model too. I mean, the thing, when you take venture capital at the of the amount that these young startups are taking, it's not in order for them to become successful businesses. It's in order for them to become what's known as a platform monopoly. That means you establish a complete and total monopoly in a particular area, like Amazon did with books, and then you leverage that monopoly to go into someone else's business, like streaming media or cloud services or big box retail.
So you're saying in Uber's case, I mean, basically the model is to drive all the taxi companies out of business, and then you get control over that whole industry?
Right. So because they don't really plan on making money in the taxi industry, what they do is they use their war chest of cash to undercut everybody else in the business, put every other taxi company out of business, even if you don't make a profit doing that. Doesn't matter if you make a profit. It doesn't matter if the drivers can stay alive doing it. It doesn't matter if you destroyed ride sharing and taxis, as long as you leverage your monopoly into another industry before you've completely killed the first one.
It's a fairly cynical way of looking at things. I mean, I don't know
it's
what
not cynical.
I don't know
it's
what
just,
Uber would say in response to that critique, that they don't actually, they're ultimately, they don't care about giving people rides.
That's not their business. That's not their job. Their job is to return 100x or 1,000x returns to their investors. The only real problem with the system, other than that it's kind of destructive and stupid, the only real problem with it is that they don't take anyone into account other than the capital investor. You know, there used to be these three, what they called factors of production. That's the three things that you need for any business to happen. You need land, you need labor, and you need capital. So land is the place where it's happening, the town in which you're running your taxis, where you need roads in order for those taxis to run. There's the labor, who are the drivers, and there's the capital, which is the war chest that you use. Now, when you only value the war chest, you end up with disenfranchised labor, which is what we're seeing, people who can't earn enough driving Uber cars to keep themselves alive, and you end up with capitalists, with the people who are putting in the money, making all the decisions and getting all the returns.
Well, let's talk about workers for a moment. So you're saying that we need to take care of the workers. You know, they need to be part of this process, I mean, to benefit from all of this. What can be done to make work more rewarding, both in the monetary sense and in terms of what people want to do?
Well, the easiest thing is to make your workers owners of the company. There's a competitor to Walmart in the western United States now called Winco. And Winco is beating Walmart in every market where they're competing head to head. And the funny thing is Winco pays its workers more and is a worker-owned cooperative. So instead of being owned by distant shareholders or the New York Stock Exchange, it's owned by the people who work there. So they not only pay themselves more as their bosses, but when the company makes money by, even if it's by exploiting them, they make money on the back end as the shareholders in the company. So you end up rewarded for all that overtime or anything that seemed uncompensated up front.
But why are they beating Walmart then? I mean, can they compete with Walmart in terms of prices?
They can compete with Walmart in terms of prices. And that's the thing that the Walmart people ask me. How could they compete with us in terms of prices if they're paying their workers more? This doesn't make sense. The reason why it makes sense is because they're not taking 90% of their revenue and handing it over to the shareholders. They don't have these millions of people passively making money off the company by simply owning shares.
Are you basically saying that that companies shouldn't go public?
If you have any choice, no, you should not go public. You should try to stay private where you can maintain some control over your company. Or we need to change the underlying code, the underlying bylaws of corporations, so that you're allowed to do something legally other than increase the share price. When you're legally bound as a CEO to promote share price over everything else, you end up destroying your company. That's what the CEOs of the Fortune 100 tell me every time I meet one. I'm killing my company because I have to show growth for my shareholders. I'm selling off our most productive assets. I'm amputating our best limbs. I'm cannibalizing our company because I have to show growth. I wish there was a way I could convince them that we could be a successful company for the next 20 years if you don't force me to kill it right now.
So let's play this out a little bit. I mean, suppose a bunch of people realize what you've just been talking about, that especially in the digital economy, that, you know, there's something corrupt, there's something sort of withering about all of this, and, you know, the end game is not going to work out. What's the alternative? How could things be structured differently?
Well, the easy ones are things like platform cooperatives, where you have your workers own the platform. So if Uber, before they went public, if they said, look, we're going to take 10% of our shares and give them to the drivers, commensurate with how much they actually drove, that changes the whole equation. And that's a completely easy one. Of course, you could start a company from scratch that way, where your users are your owners. The difference between an industrial age economy and a digital age economy is that digital technology is distributed. It's networked. So the way you want to do business in a distributed age is to make your users rich. So that would be something like YouTube, say. YouTube right now gives a teeny little bit of the ad revenue that people get off their videos. It'll give it back to the person who put up the video.
Right.
It should be 50-50. If they did a 50-50 deal, could you imagine how many people are going to start making videos right. and trying to go in there and become part of that thing?
Yeah, right.
My mantra, really, for when I go and talk to these companies is make your users rich. Think eBay, which has millions of users who are dedicated to the platform because the platform has allowed them to generate income in a way that they really couldn't do that before. I mean, I don't mean to be sad. I'm actually happy because people are getting this. Developers are getting this. And they're realizing that the easy way to have a successful company is just take less money to begin with so that you're not beholden to these venture capitalists to pivot your business to some really awful thing which doesn't match what your initial intention was.
Well, that was reporter Douglas Rushkoff, who's written a new book called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. He was speaking with reporter Steve Paulson of the program To the Best of Our Knowledge, which appears on our WMNF HD3 channel, The Source. Well, as we listen to these interviews today, please comment by sending your email to dj@wmnf.org. Next up, modern workers, mainly seniors, who are nomadic, living on the edge here in the U.S. from paycheck to paycheck. There's a growing trend among workers in the U.S., migrant workers, but these are not agricultural workers from Latin America. These are people who were born here, who travel from town to town as migrant workers, and it's a growing trend. Who are they? What kind of work do they do? Well, they work in low-wage seasonal gigs, picking fruit. They sell Halloween pumpkins, Christmas trees, or 4th of July fireworks. Some scrub toilets in national forest campgrounds. They guard the gates of oil fields and run the rides at theme parks. Our guest, Jessica Bruder, embedded herself in this community of migrant workers. For 2 years, she drove more than 15,000 miles across the country. She worked alongside them in Amazon's Camper Force fulfillment centers and at the grueling annual sugar beet harvest in North Dakota. And she followed them through employment in national parks, where they served as campground custodians in exchange for a place to park their houses on wheels and work for near minimum wage. Jessica Bruder, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So how did you get an idea that there was this community of people on the road?
Yeah, well, I read a lot as a journalist and had been reading just a bit about people working in Amazon's warehouses. And this was after the press had found that there was one warehouse where rather than install air conditioners, they were letting people pass out and having ambulances stationed outside, which I thought was pretty horrifying. So I was curious about those conditions, and I'd been reading about them. And in one article, there were a couple paragraphs talking about RVers who were there doing pick and pack in the warehouse. They were traditional retirement-aged folks, but they couldn't afford to retire. And they told the reporter that, and then the story moved on elsewhere, but I kind of got stuck there. I couldn't stop thinking about it. And so I started poking around online and learned that, lo and behold, there was an entire community of workers on wheels, many of them older, doing thousands of jobs around the country. You mentioned many of them, and it's just, it's a sprawling employment network looking for workers like these who essentially are plug-and-play labor. They show up with their homes. Typically, they're not really around long enough to organize or ask for much in the way of benefits or protections. And then, you know, when the employer wants them gone, they're back on the road.
Now, when I think of older people, I think of Social Security. I think once you reach the age of 65 or now 66, that everything's set. You've got Medicare, you've got Social Security, and your life here in the U.S. is going to be secure.
Yeah, I mean, Social Security was never meant to be enough to live on. It's supposed to be a supplement, and depending on what your lifetime earnings are, you know, particularly for women who have lower lifetime earnings than men because they may have taken time out of the workplace to serve as unpaid caregivers, and we still have that gender wage gap, a lot of people's lifetime earnings didn't really allow them to accrue enough Social Security to live on. I met people for whom it's, you know, it's a few hundred dollars a month. So that's not enough to live on, let alone retire on. And a lot of people have hit the road.
Now, several of the people that you write about in Nomadland, they once were living high on the hog. They were once pretty high flyers, and then their life in the middle class came crashing down.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people were caught broadsided by the 2008 market crash, and just when the housing bubble burst, a lot of people planned to retire on the equity from their homes, which were suddenly worthless. a bunch of people who had 401ks, saw those or other savings plans that were invested in the market evaporate, which in part is a consequence of the move from defined benefit pensions to 401ks. You know, the risk has been shifted from the employer to the worker, and, you know, this is what can happen as a consequence of that shift.
You tell a lot of personal stories in Nomadland. Toward the beginning, there's a story of a woman who travels up and down throughout the western U.S. and works in campgrounds. Tell us about that woman, and tell us a little bit more about what her camper looks like.
Sure. I think you're referring to Linda May,
yep,
who is amazing. She's in her mid-60s, really spent her life on the low-wage treadmill doing tons of jobs, could not put enough away, and you know, found herself experiencing some ageism in the workplace, had been a project manager at Home Depot, but then could only get work at the register and not really enough of it, and you know, was pretty much trapped. She was paying $600 a month rent for this tiny trailer, and it was like, you know, this isn't, there was no good end game. So if we flash forward, nowadays Linda has a tiny trailer called the Squeeze In, which is, she went work camping there in San Bernardino National Forest, so I think that's the one you're talking about.
Yep.
But it's a fiberglass clamshell from the 70s that I believe the company Hunter originally said that this was a crowning achievement and travel for fun and adventure and would purr like a kitten on the road and track like a tiger when the going went tough. But, you know, this was meant as a recreational vehicle.
And it's 40-year-old technology.
Yeah, it's made of fiberglass. It looks like one of those clamshell containers that they used to put hamburgers in before we wised up to the evils of styrofoam. And it's about 5'3" tall inside, and Linda is 5'2", so she calls it the Squeeze In.
So it sounds pretty uncomfortable. Is it that once you retire, that this is as good as it's going to get?
Yeah, it's not easy. I mean, it's not what people typically think of when they think of retirement. I was very confused when I met people who were older and working at Amazon or working the sugar beet harvest, and they told me that they were retirees. I was like, you know, this looks tiring, but not maybe like retirement. So, it definitely surprised me.
Yeah. So, Amazon is famous for its secrecy and famous for its poor working conditions in its warehouse. How did you get a job at one of these Amazon fulfillment centers?
I applied. They've got my social security number. I still have my badge, my laminate.
Again,
they do what they call bulk hiring.
And what does that mean?
Bulk hiring means they're trying to bring in so many warm bodies to staff the peak season right before the holidays that it's kind of like a cattle call. In some ways, I would have been almost narcissistic to think that I'd get filtered out as a journalist just because they're bringing in so many people that, you know, it's kind of open season.
So they didn't suspect that you were one of these pesky journalist types that was undercover trying to look at the working conditions of Amazon?
No, I don't believe they did, and it's funny because in my cohort there were about 30 of us who were being onboarded at the same time. Most everyone was north of 60, and at the time I was 37, and I really did stick out like a sore thumb, and I worried at first, and then, you know, then I got used to being there and got treated like one of the gang.
Well, we're talking with Jessica Bruder about her brand new book, Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So what were the working conditions like in Amazon?
Intense. I mean, it's funny because they talk about how you get these 15-minute breaks, but by the time you walk back to the break room, you've expended half of it. Very regimented. There are walk paths on the floor that you're not supposed to leave. If you go to use the restroom, there's a color-coded chart that you're supposed to match your urine with to determine if you need more water. There are Orwellian slogans on the walls, including problems are treasures and variation is the enemy. I worked with the Kiva robot, so that was a lot of stooping and stretching, but I know people who did more of the walking jobs who were in Camper Force, and one of them, a gentleman in his early 70s, was walking 15 miles a day.
Wow. What's a Kiva robot?
Yeah, so Kiva was the manufacturer of these robots. Amazon bought the company. Now they're called Amazon Robotics. But everybody, when I was there, was still calling them Kivas. And I believe they weigh about 300 pounds, and they move the shelves around the warehouse. So instead of workers walking to the shelves, at least in most of the warehouse, there are some areas that remain unautomated, including one called Damage Land, where I got to work, where all the broken items go. But in the Kiva areas, basically the robots bring the shelves to you. So instead of walking through endless aisles looking for the right shelf with a product, a robot brings it. So instead of doing lots of walking, you're doing a lot more stooping, climbing a stepladder, lifting, squatting, because you're actually able to perform more tasks, and you're just doing a kind of different sort of physical labor.
Hmm. So what do they pay at Amazon, and do they have any sort of benefits?
I believe there's some offer of health insurance, but the funny thing is these are short-term workers, and I know there's, you know, I believe it's at least a few months that you have to be there to be eligible for it, so I don't think that helps very much. I'm not aware of any other benefits, and I believe, I don't know what their starting wage is this year. In the past, it's been, I think when I was there, it's $10.25. Forgive me, I know sometimes that's what it's been. It tends to change year to year and place to place, and there is a bonus for working overnight, but it's, you know, it's de minimis.
And in terms of the temperature inside the warehouse, was it comfortable?
It was comfortable, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like Amazon may know, okay, we can hire senior citizens because they've got Medicare, so we don't have to even think about offering them, you know, for the 2 or 3 or 4 months of the high season. We don't have to think about offering them health care, so we'll just hire these seniors. They'll come in and work for $10.50 an hour. They'll be happy, and we'll make a lot of money.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that happens, too, is it's funny, and I've heard this said again and again, is that Amazon really likes their can-do attitude. And the way it comes across, frankly, is almost patronizing. They talk about the camper effect, how, you know, these people with their Eisenhower work ethic, how they might have some sort of good psychological impact on the disaffected millennials around, which I didn't really see. I've seen a lot of marketing material where Amazon makes it look like Camper Force is summer camp and like it's really, really fun. There's a newsletter that went out. The headline was Camper Force, the value of friendship. So it's really, it's kind of surreal. And what I have heard the recruiters say over and over is that, yeah, these workers might not be as fast as the younger workers, but they show up and they don't complain, and their attendance rates are just excellent. So they're beloved for that.
So Amazon's Camper Force, this is where Amazon has a big warehouse and people come in their campers to work temporarily in the high season. Does this happen all over the country at Amazon centers throughout the U.S.?
It's only selected warehouses. I think the warehouses have to specifically request Camper Force. So it's changed a lot. You know, the warehouse I was at in Hazlitt doesn't have Camper Force this year. So it really just kind of moves all over.
Yeah.
It's a nomadic program.
Do the workers show up in their campers when they drive up to the warehouse?
Well, they'd rather not, because campers take a fair amount of gas.
Yeah.
So often people, if somebody has a sedan, people will carpool. And Amazon will contract with the local RV park to give everybody a place to stay.
Uh-huh.
So often you kind of have these ephemeral company towns that are, you know, within a half an hour of the warehouse. And that's where people are living and congregating, and then they'll commute together to work.
You know, when we think of migrant workers, I think a lot of us think about the agricultural workers, especially people from South America and Central America who come here, and some settle into the U.S. and become migrant workers, follow the stream from Florida up to North Carolina, then to Ohio. But this is really a new kind of migrant worker. Do you think that the numbers, how big are the numbers, and are the numbers growing?
It's very hard to tell. Anecdotally, I would guess in the tens of thousands or more, and I do think it's growing. But again, because this is a population that's nomadic, and to the best of my knowledge, nobody is doing that demographic research, I don't have a firm number to fix it to. I just know what I hear of in terms of how many jobs are out there, what the demand is, and stuff like that. But I do hope when people think about this, they will, rather than kind of contract on it, I hope they will expand how they think of migrant labor rather than just kind of profiling it as, you know, this is a certain type of people. Like, it's wider than you think, and this is another sort of it, but it is indeed migrant labor. I went on a show once, and they said, don't use that phrase because that's Mexicans. And frankly, I was kind of offended. I was like, migrant labor also can look like those people. Why don't you expand your definition of what that is rather than just sticking a label on one group?
Yeah, I think you make that case really well in the book. You went to the sugar beet harvest in North Dakota. What was that work like?
Interesting. So much of the work of pulling the beets from the fields has now been mechanized. So there are these big harvester machines that go through the fields, and then haul trucks that drive at breakneck pace to get the sugar beets from the fields to the storage piles, which are usually near refineries. And it's kind of nuts because for that particular time of year in these jobs, they often don't require the truck drivers to have commercial driver's license. So there are always accidents and spills, and it's intense. They call the month-long harvest period, which can, you know, it can last as short as 2 weeks if the weather's good, but it can span a month. They call it a campaign, as if they're going to war. So what the work campers do is they show up, and they are what's known as ground crew for the most part. So when the trucks come in and they dump those multi-ton loads of sugar beets into these huge hoppers, which will kind of suck them into a big machine with a boom that makes basically builds gigantic sugar beet mountains. There's always a lot of spillage. So our job was shoveling. And, you know, these beets can be as big as basketballs. It feels like you're shoveling frozen turkeys. And you're out there on 12-hour shifts, and it's cold. And it's the sort of thing that left my body plenty sore. And when I was doing it, again, I was 37, and there were people much older doing it around me, and I was just incredibly impressed by their fortitude and also just a little distressed to see that the people at that age were in a position where they needed to do this kind of work.
Was it dangerous?
I think so. I mean, we had an emergency shutdown within, you know, I'd just been there a couple days, and a harvester's, like a 7-foot steel pole that broke off a harvester, and they didn't see it, and it was hidden in the pile of sugar beets that came off a truck, and it got sucked into the piling machine and was going up the conveyor belt and almost made it into the hopper, which tumbles the beets around and dumps the dirt off. And if it had gotten in there, I mean, I suspect the company was more worried about the machine than about us, but that could have been incredibly dangerous. We had to do an emergency shutdown. Around the same time, one of my coworkers hurt his knee. I heard about somebody breaking a wrist. It's funny because I was only there to get a taste of it and go. I didn't have like a whole chapter to write about the sugar beet harvest. But initially when I left, I felt kind of guilty about it. Just like, my team, I've left them behind. But within, you know, another day or two, my whole team had quit. So they anticipate that sort of attrition, and I think they just hire as much as they can.
Did you buy a camper yourself in order to do this book?
I did. So the book started as a magazine project, and for that I did not buy a camper. I borrowed a tent. But then I was signed up to do a book project with the publisher Norton, and I was able to buy a camper van. So I bought a 95 GMC Vandura conversion, and that became my ride.
How many miles did that get to the gallon?
Oh, not how many gallons does it get to the mile is more like it. I will confess, this was not as environmentally friendly a reporting project as I would have liked. Probably 12.
Yeah. So
a newer vehicle would probably do better. I mean, it's got a lot of particle board cabinets inside that I imagine weigh quite a bit.
Wow. So despite the insecurity and despite the, you know, the high cost of gasoline and the money is running out at the end of the month, as you write in the book, and you know, these are really tough working conditions for these folks, mostly seniors, these new modern nomads, these migrant workers. There's quite a lot of camaraderie and humor in your book, too, that these folks don't feel sorry for themselves.
No, and these folks are amazing. I mean, I find myself quoting the author Rebecca Solnit, who I very much admire. She did a book called A Paradise Built in Hell, so about the extraordinary communities that arise from disaster zones, including environmental disasters. And if we look at the economy as a human-made disaster, there really are some utopian communities and communities of mutual aid to rise out of that. And I definitely feel like the people I met are included, just the way they support each other. They're ingenious. I mean, they're so smart. They're so creative. They're so resilient and incredibly generous within the community. And that impressed me a whole lot.
So if I'm driving through a city and I'm going through a big box store parking lot like a Walmart or a Target, or I'm driving through a grocery store parking lot, and I see a car or a van or a camper where somebody's obviously living out of that car, van, or camper, what do you think the chances are that that's some sort of nomadic worker and not just simply a homeless person?
Pretty high, and I think a lot of the people who are living out of vehicles actually take umbrage at the word homeless. They'd rather be called houseless because the vehicle has become their home.
Well, that was Jessica Bruder, the author of a brand new book called Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century, and she looked at modern migrant workers here in the U.S. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Midpoint Show with Mitch Perry. He's coming along in just a moment. We'll get the NPR news first. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. James Lyles was our phone producer.